Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Matthew.
Episode 276, recorded for the week of September 17th and the 24th. New from AWS, Elastic Commute, flex your way to an empty office. Good evening, Jonathan and Matt. How's it going?
It's going good.
I was supposed to record with Jonathan on Friday last week, and for once in a long time, I failed. Completely failed. now, Jonathan didn't text me either, so I sort of put it on Jonathan slightly, although I'll take full blame. But he messaged me on Slack, and I ignored the notification on my phone, and then saw it several hours later after he had given up on me, and I was supposed to record with him. So sorry about that, Jonathan. I try to do better in the future.
That's right. Secretly, I was hoping that you weren't going to show up anyway. So it all worked out pretty well.
So now I have to join you at 9 o'clock on a Friday. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, well, things happen. Because it's been 2 weeks and one of them was Oracle Open World, we have a lot to get through. So let's jump right into it. First up, IBM is acquiring Kubernetes cost optimization startup KubeCost. I think IBM is quickly becoming the place where cloud cost companies go to be assimilated, die, or rebirthed into something worse than they were originally, as I think they now own 5 different solutions, including big ones like Apptio, Turbonomic, and Instana, which they have bought over the last few years. With the acquisition of KubeCost, a FinOps startup that helps teams monitor and optimize their Kubernetes cluster costs, or they focus on efficiency and ultimately lowering your cost, KubeCost gives them the access to the open source project OpenCost, which is a vendor-neutral open source project that forms a core part of KubeCost commercial offerings, and OpenCost is part of the Cloud Native Computing Foundation. So IBM, I guess, gets the management oversight of it. KubeCost is expected to be integrated into IBM FinOps suite of cloud abilities and Turbonomic, and there's also speculation that it might make its way into the OpenShift product, which would make the most sense to me of any place they could put it.
What am I missing exactly that's specific to Kubernetes for cost optimization rather than any other kind of cloud cost optimization?
I mean, pods. How do you price out pods?
It's all inside. It's inside the cluster.
Yeah. It's all inside the house. So basically, you know, from most of the FinOps tools are giving you costs of the EC2 instances or the virtual machines that run the nodes. But if you want to understand like how much of the node is being used by this service or this pod, that isn't easily extracted in most of the cloud cost management tools. And so KubeCost lives inside of Kubernetes and basically has the ability to see how much CPU, how much memory they're using, and then calculate basically the price of the EC2 broken down into the different pods and services.
Okay, that's pretty useful. I guess it's not just reducing costs, but it's cost awareness. Perhaps if you want to divide your cost up between different services running on the same cluster.
Correct.
Yeah, it's just tagging the pods and then pulling that metadata out. So it's able to read all of it at that level versus the EC2 or any of the other services level.
I mean, nice if that was built into the platform completely rather than being a separate tool.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the idea of it getting, you know, donating open cost to the Cloud Native Computing Foundation was that the goal was that it would get, you know, pulled into Kubernetes core and be, at least the APIs would be there. Maybe you still need to do some magic to expose them, like you do with things like Aqua's APIs that they put in originally for container security. You know, they contributed that part of it to the open source project, but then to leverage those APIs, you needed a tool like Orca or Aqua or any of the other container security companies that have now come to be.
Cool. I think IBM's kind of becoming the holding company for all kinds of things right now.
They've always been the holding company for all kinds of things. It's just they've arrived at the cloud era and they're buying things they can't. So
it'd be interesting if they integrated it with like Terraform somehow too. Like kind of made it into that whole ecosystem. But
I mean, they could since they, you know, the HashiCorp acquisition hasn't closed yet. They are about to own it. So yeah, there's a Terraform cost plugin that gives you kind of an idea of what your Terraform plan and will cost you when it applies, which is kind of neat, which would, you know, this could extend into that for Kubernetes.
Yeah. I played with that plugin once. It was kind of cool. But it was really early in the days. I haven't used it in the last couple of years. I have it passed to my team to set up for my day job just because I was curious as a fun tool to set up, but I haven't actually played with it in the last couple of years.
Let's move on to AI. OpenAI has a new product this week called OpenAI 01 Preview. And this LLM is special because it's the first reasoning LLM, allegedly. The idea behind reasoning models is to take more time to think before they respond to you. This allows them to reason through complex tasks and solve harder problems than previous models in science, coding, and math. ChatGPT is releasing the first with the OpenAI 01 Preview, which they expect to ship regular updates and improvements to. And alongside this release, they're considering evaluations for the next updates, which are in development. In ChatGPT's test, they said the model performed similarly to a PhD student on benchmark tasks in physics, chemistry, and biology, and it also excels in math and coding. So basically, the International Mathematics Olympiad, or the IMO, basically had GPT-4o correctly solve only 13% of the problems, while the reasoning model scored an 83% on the same test. As part of the development of these models, OpenAI has come up with some new safety training approaches that harness the reasoning capabilities to make them adhere to safety and alignment guidelines. And one way they measure this is by testing how well the model continues its safety rules after a user bypasses them through jailbreaking. One of their hardest tests, GPT-4o, scores 22 out of 100, whereas the 01 preview scored 84. So I had a chance to play with this over the last couple of weeks. And, you know, it was, I was asking some coding ideas and some samples of things. And so the code that ChatGPT-4o provided to me didn't work on first attempt. It failed, a Python compile error. And when I ran the same thing through the reasoning engine, I got a much better outcome and actually ran and did what I told it to do. I also was using it to create some images, some meme generation, as I typically use AI for. It's my number one use case. And it was able to take my prompt suggestions and turn it into a much more compelling answer that I was then able to take to Gemini and tell it to draw an image for me that looked pretty darn good. I was very impressed with it as well. So yeah, this is a interesting idea. And yeah, if you slow down the AI just a little bit and you say, why don't you double check your work? It'll give you better answers, amazingly enough.
So I have not played with the O1 preview. I've been all in on Claude lately. Been playing around with different system prompts to promote the whole the idea of the chain of thought thing. So I know OpenAI say the reasoning engine is not just chain of thought under the hood, but I'm curious to know what it was you asked it, and I'll run your prompts through what I've got, because I do a similar thing where I like evaluate what was asked and then sort of like almost fan out ideas from the central topic, in a way, just having like other ideas be present as tokens in the context window gives the LLM the opportunity to kind of explore more options in the answers that it gives. And so, I'll be interesting. We should do a joint dinner thing, I think, to compare the results of that.
Yeah, I'm down for it. I'll send you over my prompts. You send me over some of yours, and I'll run it through my my ChatGPT trial, and you can run it through your Claude, and we'll see how it turns out.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I did some pretty cool stuff. You know, kids in school, math practice online, stuff like that. That's extra math for them. I don't know if your kids did extra math. I expect they did. My son absolutely hates extra math. He hates the timer. He's grown to detest the whole thing. I was like, okay, let's see if we can build a single page web app that basically does the same thing, which is just like single digit multiplication or division practice in JavaScript using AI, and like four or five sentences with the chain of thought prompt that I have, and we got a working math fact practice app with literally 15 seconds. It's absolutely astounding.
It's pretty darn cool.
Amazing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll come back to you when I get back from my vacation, and we'll figure that out. we'll do some experimentation. All right, let's move on to AWS. So AWS had something to say to the UK watchdog and the Competition and Markets Authority in the UK, and that is that Amazon customers were packing their bags and heading back on-prem, facing stiff competition from on-premise infrastructure, which is an about-face after saying that all workloads would eventually move to the cloud. AWS listed several examples of customers returning to their data centers, and AWS said building a data center requires significant effort, so the fact that customers are doing it highlights the level of flexibility that they have and the attractiveness of moving back to on-premises. AWS points that 29% of all cloud customers surveyed have switched back to an on-premise service for at least one workload, which is not just AWS, that is also Google and Azure. And, you know, this is a convenient lawyer case to basically argue why you're not a monopoly. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how true it is. Because again, like, even when I scour the Twitters or the Mastodons, looking for people who are moving back on-prem, there's really only a few key use cases that people repeatedly point back to. And that's, you know, DHH and Basecamp, and then some of the early days with Dropbox, which is a completely different use case that I think, you know, has a volume of scale that does make more sense on-premise. But I think for your most common applications and your most common things, I don't know that it's as quite as aggressive as they're saying it is here in this particular conversation.
I wouldn't say it's quite as aggressive, but I've definitely started seeing more articles, and I've talked with a few companies in the last couple of years that are really kind of evaluating whether their cloud moves were the right moves and whether to move back or not. And the other piece of it is these companies either are using highly specialized, highly specialized workloads that don't really fit the cloud, or they're large enough that it makes sense to keep them running. But the majority of customers, if you're doing a simple app, the cloud makes more sense.
Mm-hmm.
I still think.
Yeah,
clearly, but I'm biased.
Yes, of course we're biased. You're listening to a CloudPod podcast. I do think there are use cases that don't make sense on cloud. And I think the reality is that Amazon did a lot of damage early on by saying everything should eventually move to the cloud. And it gave this pretense that everything should. And I think the right answer is most of your, scalable things that can move should be considered moving. But your databases, your mainframes, there's maybe not as much compelling of a reason to do that. You don't get the cost advantages. They're typically pets. They don't get elasticity. And so I think there's definitely a different way to think about some of these apps. And I think that's why we're probably going to see hybrid continue for a while. I think multi-cloud makes sense because, I can run Oracle and OCI and I can save a bunch of money by doing that. And I get the best Oracle environment I can get because they're experts. And I can go to Amazon and I can get the best web server tier and, some of the best tools around how to manage a web server farm at scale and how to do that dynamically and efficiently because that's what they're really good at. Or I have a really good AI ML workload. Maybe you're talking to Azure, maybe you're talking to Google, but there's different clouds have different areas where they kind of honed in their special sweet sauce. And so I think that's why multi-cloud became such a popular move for companies was that, well, my Windows workloads, if I put them on Azure, I have licensing advantage. If I put my non-Windows workloads on Amazon, I get all the other advantages of that. And so I think that's what we've seen with multi-cloud. I think that's why also hybrid is probably here for the long term for some companies.
I think we're kind of, so the quotes in the article, things Amazon said was 8 years ago. And things were very different 8 years ago. They didn't have the same number of customers or the same types of customers. And so when they say things like, if you want to go multi-cloud, then you'll end up with the lowest common denominator, I think that was a reasonable assertion to make back then, because that's what people thought multi-cloud was finding the cheapest computer any moment in time or finding the cheapest storage. These massive use cases like Dropbox or Basecamp, I don't think we even considered those 8 years ago as being something to worry about in a way. I don't know. It's interesting that they kind of having to backpedal on some of that advice, really.
Well, I mean, I think they were forced to because they chose a position in a market that was very aggressive. And their competitors said, you're being a monopoly and you're basically eliminating people's choice by saying this is the only option. And so they've been forced into a corner by these marketing tactics they took. And I think that's part of the challenge they've had. And now, we'll talk about, we talked about a couple weeks ago, Amazon and Oracle signing a partnership to run, to connect AWS to Oracle Cloud. And so now they're hearing what their customers are saying, which is that we don't want one cloud. We want the ability to be flexible and have options and choice.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to kind of reiterate what you said in a different way, one of my things I've always said is use the right tool in the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
So leverage the different clouds for for different workloads. And if they are isolated workloads, if you don't have a monolith, but you can, you're a company that's acquired other companies or you have it, put the right workloads in the right locations so that for things that make sense for you. Your mainframe, like you said, unless if you're going to completely transform or modernize it, leave it in your data center. It's going to be easier to maintain and cheaper. Where your SQL and your .NET, Microsoft probably has some advantages, like you said. So if you kind of can take your workloads and if they are isolated and you're large enough to be able to manage multiple clouds. Because that's the other piece of it, is actually having the right team to manage the clouds. Definitely, I agree with what they're saying here. Mm-hmm. I don't think to the scale that they want to say it to, but still a fact.
Yeah, I definitely think in, you know, the economic climate that we're in right now, I think a lot of companies are asking themselves, like, was this cloud cost thing the right way to go? And I think that's probably a factor. But also, like, a lot of these AI use cases that we're talking about that, you know, all the Wall Street people are excited about and investing in companies for, you couldn't do that as easily on-prem. And you can't get the GPUs on-prem like this. And so, you know, again, there's advantages to all the models. And I think it's about figuring out what the right balance for any company is.
Yeah, I think they were still right, though. I think everything will end up in cloud. It may not be a public cloud. I think it's still the right mindset about service-oriented delivery of infrastructure, mm-hmm. regardless of whether it's AWS or your own data center that you run as a cloud.
Well, if you've enjoyed your time working from home a few days a week and, you know, going into your office 2 or 3 days a week, those days are over if you're an Amazon employee. Andy Jassy says, it's time to return to the office full time. Jassy wrote this in a memo he sent out on September 16th. And since that came out, the internet has basically imploded of Amazon employees looking for new work. Jassy, though, says he feels good about the progress they are making across stores, AWS, and advertising, as well as Prime Video expansion and investment areas like GenAI, Cooper, and healthcare, and several other areas he says are evolving nicely. But he talks about, you know, hey, when he started the company 27 years ago, he had a plan to stay for a few years, but that the unique culture of Amazon has really made him stay, and really he, you know, rationalized with that. And it's a key part of how the success of Amazon has been driven is by their culture. And so he says the S team, which for those of you who don't know, the S team is basically the executive team that manages all of Amazon's businesses, wants Amazon to operate like the world's largest startup, which means it has a passion for constantly inventing for customers, a strong urgency for big opportunities, high ownership, and fast decision-making, and a scrappiness. As part of those questions, the S team have been thinking about whether they have the right organizational structure to drive the ownership and speed they desire, and two, whether they are set to up to invent, collaborate, and be connected to each other and the culture to deliver the absolute best for the customers in the business. And they concluded they could do better on both. And to do this, they decided that they have too much management, and this is slowing down and causing bureaucracy in the business. And to solve this, they plan to increase the ratio of individual contributors to managers by 15% by the end of Q1 2025. With fewer managers, they will remove layers and flatten the organization. And if it's done well, it will improve the ability to move fast, clarify, and invigorate a sense of ownership and drive decision-making closer to the front lines where it most impacts customers. And he points out that they have created needless bureaucracy across the business. And to solve that, he's created a bureaucratic mailbox where you can send all your bureaucratic complaints to, and he says he'll read it. Bullshit. But someone will read it and report to him, I'm sure. The controversial part is that the time to return to the office is 5 days a week. They want to return to the pre-pandemic days when being out of the office was an exception. And they will bring back assigned desks in the U.S. because they know many of their employees will need to make accommodations. The new way of working will start on January 2nd, 2025. And, you know, I don't know how well you can innovate and do the right things for your customers if you lose all of your senior talent to attrition. So I'm definitely a little concerned about maybe what I would call 2025, maybe the last year for Amazon.
Yeah, they may have had that culture before, but then the pandemic happened and people realized that things didn't have to be that way and things could be different, and they see the benefits. And, you know, I don't think he's going to make the change that he thinks he is by doing this. I think it'll demotivate people. You can't force culture change through policy. That's not what the culture is. Culture is the result of all the things that you do, including those policies. It emerges. It's not like you have a manifesto that says this is our company culture, although many people do.
Well, I mean, Amazon has the leadership principles, which basically are
their definition
of a culture. Again, I don't know how much of that culture actually exists in the hearts and minds of Amazonians versus the S team. But, you know, they definitely hire for it. They definitely look for people who meet those leadership principles. And so you are biased to potentially get, you know, people who will help support and foster the culture that you want in the business. But I agree with you. But once you've seen a different way of working, and do those things change, and going back to the old way isn't necessarily the right decision.
Yeah. I mean, they should try and in my opinion. They should try and build a way to make people want to go back to the office rather than mandating it.
Mm-hmm.
Like incentivize people at work, give them cool projects to work on, but they're projects that you need to get together as a team for some reason. But you know, with all the cost cutting, and there's like no domestic or international travel for people. People aren't going to conferences. People working in Seattle, but their team's somewhere else in the country. They can't go and see them in person. But now they've got to go and sit at a desk in an office in Seattle instead of in the comfort of their homes. It's all very strange. It's like not a good assessment of the best way to solve the problem that they have.
I mean, I can play devil's advocate here in some ways, where there are certain things I do believe that work better in person.
Oh, and, for sure. Yeah.
And like kicking off a project, finalizing projects, handing off, you know, check-ins, things like that, that do work fundamentally better in person because you can get people in the room. And let's be honest, one, as we do the podcast, how many times have you guys gotten distracted and done other things? Just, and this is outside of work and or when you're in work, when you're stuck in 6 hours of meeting a day, how much are you all actually paying attention to said meeting versus doing 16 other things that you could be doing? So I do believe that kind of one, getting out of the 8 hours of meeting straight in the like at home and is useful. I don't necessarily know that just mandating 5 days a week, but at one point, if you do believe that getting people in the office 100% is the only way to do it, you got to pull the ripcord because, and as a business, be ready to re-implement, which is kind of sounds like they are, because I've seen companies where they're like, hey, everyone come back into the office every day, but we don't have enough desk space. And oh, by the way, you know, you're going to be hotel desking, so you can't leave anything at the office. But there's no comforts as there used to be of, you have a desk, you have your tea or coffee at your desk, you have whatever. So, and the other thing I've seen them, which Justin read here, which is they're giving them advance notice. You know, I have a friend of a friend who was literally told, oh, next week you have to come into the office 5 days a week. Okay, cool. But their daycare picks up at 5 o'clock. And that was the advantage of this, where they can go get their child at, you know, 5 o'clock. You can leave at 4:45. And that was their goal. So like giving some notice, like they feel like they're trying to do it in a way that should have some level of success.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think they're being somewhat generous to allow people, you know, plenty of opportunity, 3 months to figure out new childcare situations and that, but it's still a disruption. And then there's all the people who, you know, were hired remotely during pandemic who can't move to an office location. You know, are they now sitting in a situation where they're, you know, potentially out of a job in 6 months through some layoff because they're not getting the FaceTime of being in the office? I mean, like you hire these people under a pretense that they're remote.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're changing the direction of the company, and that's also bad too. And those people aren't bad just because they live in Nebraska. They're perfectly capable people probably who do really good work, and they're now in a situation where move from Nebraska, a very cheap place to live, to a very expensive place like Seattle or New York or one of the other hubs of Amazon Web Services, and you know, or wait to get laid off because you're not performing at the level they expect you to because you're not in the office.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tough scenario.
And there were a few very good DevOps people in Nebraska too.
Yeah. So we'll see. You know, has Roddy been, you know, it's been a bit of a brain drain of talent. You know, I've been watching on Twitter, you know, people leaving Amazon announcing it and, you know, getting retweeted and stuff. So I suspect we'll see more of that in the next 3 to 4 months. And the people who are leaving are the people who can get jobs at Google and Facebook and the other company, you know, Oracle Cloud and all the other cloud providers. So they're all probably going to get better. Why Amazon may struggle to retain top talent or get new talent that is as good of caliber. So we'll see how it pans out for them. I'm sure it'll be a case study and a business book sometime in the future.
I mean, the question is, if Amazon's moving over to this, you can kind of see a lot of other companies moving over to this, or people just can't bounce around, and how much attrition is higher than normal right now because of these changes?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely higher from them forcing it last year, but those people that didn't leave right away. It'll be interesting if, you know, if this causes other companies to go back to 5 days a week. You know, I think some companies might be considering it now, but they're going to watch Amazon, see how it goes first before they pull this trigger. All right. Well, let's go talk about other more fun news other than people leaving Amazon. Amazon RDS for MySQL zero ETL integration with Amazon Redshift is now generally available. For those of you who love managing ETLs, this is bad news for you. But those of you who hate them, the zero ETL will basically make it easier for you to unify your data across your applications and data sources for holistic insights and break down your data silos. This release also includes new features such as data filtering, support for multiple integrations, and the ability to configure zero ETL integration in your AWS CloudFormation template directly, all doing your stuff as infrastructure as code. Get your data from MySQL to Redshift automatically.
Well, I know it sounds painful writing an ETL job in a CloudFormation template.
What's more painful is having somebody click it in a console and then lose it and then have no commit history to refer back to if they need to rebuild it again. So at least it's a manageable artifact.
You're not wrong, but I still think I want to see a JSON ETL template in my life.
Other than specifying your filtering and your some of the other parameters, I don't know how much in the CloudFormation is actually you configuring the job versus defining the data that you'd like from your MySQL that's going to end up in Redshift. And I hope Amazon handles the mappings and the transformation layer, but I don't know. I've looked at the code, so we'll see. AWS is transferring OpenSearch to the Open Search Software Foundation. OpenSearch to OpenSearch. A community-driven initiative under the Linux Foundation. This message follows leadership expansion of the project shared earlier this year and now ends Amazon's dominating control of the OpenSearch project, which, based on Elasticsearch a few weeks ago, going back to open source, I think is a good move in general. And I think OpenSearch is continuing to be the dominant player in Elastic community at this point. It's been pretty successful. We're seeing similar things with Valky being pretty heavily adopted after their licensing changes. So it's an interesting case study because I think it worked for smaller open source projects like Voldemort, who probably weren't getting a lot of community adoption anyways. I think it's worked out lesser so for Elastic and for Redis. So we'll continue to keep an eye on this.
Yeah, I think the only thing they really have left is support services.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's definitely some proprietary things that Elasticsearch has been building around AI and some of their stuff around security and those things that, maybe are not in the OpenSearch product. But again, I don't know that I want to build AI on top of that.
Yeah, I know there's like RAG use cases for Elasticsearch because it's a great vector store, but that can be added to OpenSearch too. It's not patentable. So I don't know. I think they're going to struggle in the long run now.
Has any of the other cloud providers jumped on supporting OpenSearch? And
all of them.
Or is that
other than Google, I think is like on Elastic, but OCI adopted OpenSearch. I thought Azure did as well.
Google are adopting Valky, at least.
Yeah, Google's on Valky.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Microsoft backed Redis right when it came out. I was like, ooh, that was an interesting move. It looks like there's third-party OpenSearch, but it's not directly. It's not Azure Managed Service. It's all done through partners.
Mm. I guess you got to think about the level of service they're actually offering you in that case, though. Are they giving you a Redis or Elasticsearch machine image, and then it's your responsibility to spin those up and configure them? Or is it a fully managed service?
Azure has a fully managed Redis service. Okay. For you. Backups, same thing as Elastic Cache, like where they'll manage all the pieces, scaling up, down, whatever you need. OpenSearch looks like from a 30-second real-time feedback where it is just third parties that built and shit and sell through their store. But I'll happily be wrong.
Mm. Well, Jonathan, I know you do a lot of AI music with your Deep Composer, but I'm sorry to tell you that Amazon has announced they're killing Deep Composer. It's AI powered keyboard experiment that allowed you to combine music with the online side to create your fantastic raps. The Deep Composer project just reaches 5-year milestone, and the physical MIDI piano and AWS service let users compose songs with the help of generative AI. You have until September 17th, 2025, so you at least have a year to still use your thing, to download your data stored there, and the service will end on that date. AWS also announced that the Deep Racer League is ending this year, which makes me kind of sad. And I assume that Deep Racers will also be no longer available in the Amazon store. So if you buy them now while you still have a chance before it's completely gone. The league is dying. I assume the service will die shortly after that.
It's so funny to look back and think that Deep Composer was 5 years ago.
Right?
They had AI like in the palm of their hands and let it go.
Well, I mean, so did really? Google. I mean, like, in fairness, Google and Amazon had, you know, they were on the verge. They just didn't get it done. And then ChatGPT took all the attention away.
Yep.
Because they made it available to the general public versus, you know, the niche group.
Yeah. I mean, I've been hearing, you know, before ChatGPT, I've been hearing like, oh, AI is going to be a game changer. It's so amazing. It's all like, okay. Like, but no one was really showing what they were saying was amazing and game changing. But like, you know, if Amazon had models that were similar to, you know, and we had that, I think it was that guy who got fired because he said the AI was real and, you know, he was in love with it or something. You know, all kinds of weird stories were coming out before ChatGPT. And like, now that you see it, you're like, oh, yeah, I can see how that happened. Okay. Makes a lot more sense now.
Yeah. Yeah. If you think about these models before the guardrails get put in place and before the fine tuning that absolutely makes sure that they never present any kind of unique persona to you and they are most definitely a chat button, nothing more. I can see how somebody in that position a couple of years ago could have really easily been influenced. I'm not even going to say deceived, because I think the jury's still out, really, on like the ethics of some of this stuff. But yeah, it's very easy to see how somebody could be led into that conclusion. Yeah.
It's also just another service now that AWS, wow, has deprecated this year. They had a couple earlier this year. It feels like they're finally, after many years, kind of saying, no, we need to turn off these services that we are not making us money, leveraged to, you know, give us any value back. So I'm kind of curious to see the depth of services as they're kind of
what is the criteria they're sort of looking at? You know, is it revenue? Is it margin? Is it usage? Because, you know, like there's we'll talk about it next week's show, but there, you know, there was something that was just killed that they replaced with a much better service. And people were like, I'm so annoyed they killed this. I was using it. And I'm like, well, but why didn't you move to the new thing, which is better? Like, so much better. So I think there's good V1s or MVPs that they shipped that got some adoption and some interest, but then they realized to really build the next version of them, like serverless V1 for Aurora, you know, you had to change the model, and people are upset about it because the contract sort of changed, but it's a better product now, even though it's more expensive in case of Aurora serverless too. But, you know, these things happen, and I think, you know, the amount of time they give you to deprecate off of these things is long enough that it's not the end of the world in my book, where, you know, because someone's talking about like, well, is Amazon at risk of being the next Google? And I don't think they are.
No.
Because, you know, Google killed products that people love, like Reader, and mostly consumer-facing products too, by the way. A lot of consumer stuff. But, you know, Reader is one that everyone always points to. It's like, well, I loved Reader, and it was great, and it was amazing. And it's like, yeah. And people filled the void, and, you know, Reader, you know, RSS has still been a dying thing now for a decade. It's still not as popular as it used to be. And then, you know, the other things that Google does, they deprecate their APIs really quick. So if you're using this API, like they give you like 30 days notice that this API is being deprecated in favor of the V2 or V3 API. That's not deprecating a service, but it's causing a lot of disruption to your business. And so I think, you know, Google's reputation is a reputation built over 10 years of destroying things that people use and causing pain, where Amazon is trying to be thoughtful about it, giving you, you know, probably no one has created a Deep Composer song in 6 months to a year. I forgot about the service a year after it was announced. So it's probably been actually even maybe years, and the usage is probably so low, and they're not saying it's dying tomorrow. They're giving you another year and some change to download your stuff. That feels like plenty of notice.
Which is also one of their quicker ones. Like GoCommit was like, you can keep using it for another 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. You know, it was something like, it was a multi-year thing, and like there, you can still actually sign up for it if you're in the same organization. Like, so they still are keeping some of these things around, especially more of the want to call them more business targeted ones versus Deep Composer, which is probably less business targeted.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost certain that absolutely nobody, no business is using Deep Composer to make any money, and nobody is using Deep Racer to make any money. They were almost developer advocacy tools.
They were
to drive interest in SageMaker and the other tools that were available at the time. The fact that they launched them as services to begin with is really weird. It could just have been, hey, we're doing this thing on the side. We'll call it Amazon Deep Racer. But the fact that they kind of named it as a service and now they have to kill it as a service instead of it just being this sort of ephemeral thing which happened and then went away again to drive developer interest in their tools is kind of strange. So no, killing these things doesn't bother me. People have moved past this. I mean, you can go on the web and you can simulate Deep Racer for free with like brilliant.org and stuff like this and on the AI class. And the composer thing sucked to begin with, so it's no loss there.
It was never very good, yeah.
It was not.
I mean, and that's the thing, is like there's other competitive things to make AI music that exist in the world today. There's alternative services that'll do that. But you're kind of right. Calling it a service is probably the mistake, because it really was just example applications that they built that they thought were cool to show you potential capabilities. So maybe this is where labs make sense. Like, hey, we're creating a new lab product called Deep Composer and Deep Racer, and these are fun things that we're doing to show you how to use the technology and in a fun and interesting way that isn't just coding, the world's next CRM with AI, which is, you know, a little less exciting. So, all right. Well, Amazon S3 Express OneZone now supports AWS KMS with customer managed keys, so you can encrypt your data server side with your own key. Thanks.
Yay.
Appreciate it.
This is one of those things they thought just existed.
Right? Well, why does it matter if it's one zone or two zones for a key? Whatever. It's there now. I don't have to worry about why it didn't exist before. One zone is not a thing I use. It's a very specific use case, and you shouldn't be using it for data you care about. So the fact that you need to encrypt the data you don't care about in one zone already makes me a red flag on other reasons. Now available, Graviton 4 powered memory optimized Amazon EC2 X8G instances. The Graviton 4 powered memory optimized X8G instances are available in 10 virtual sizes and 2 bare metal sizes, with up to 3 terabytes of DDR5 memory and up to 192 vCPUs. Glad to see some additional Graviton options, especially with the memory side, because that was one of the areas I always felt the Graviton chips were a bit limited, was in memory. Mm-hmm.
And now you can have 3 terabytes.
Yeah, I think the limitation on CPU was 64 or 96 before. So like this is doubling or tripling of the number of CPUs too, which that wasn't typically the Graviton performs so well that I don't see the CPU being my problem. It's really when I want to run a database in the memory. But yeah, good to see. Glad to see it. I think we're going to get Graviton 5 this year. Or do you think it's going to take another year to get it?
No, I don't think so. I don't think TSMC's got any capacity to make Graviton 5s. Too busy.
But they build them in-house now.
They're designing in-house. I don't think they're... Yes. Yeah. TSMC is making most of the chips for everybody. Intel's trying to build their foundry, but that's not going so well. And we'll talk about that next week. They might get bought. But... which would be just a crazy story. But that's next week. Stay tuned for that. Moving on to Google Compute Cloud this week. They're bringing you Safer by Default, automated access control with sensitive data protection and conditional IAM. Google Cloud sensitive data protection can automatically discover sensitive data assets and attach tags to your data assets based on the sensitivity. So things like username, email address, phone number, social security number. Using these IAM conditions, you can grant or deny access to the data based on the presence or absence of a sensitivity level tag key or tag value. There's several use cases, including automating access controls across various supported resources based on those attributes and classifications, restricting access to the supported resources like cloud storage, BigQuery, and Cloud SQL until those resources are profiled and classified by sensitive data protection, and changing access to a resource automatically as the data sensitivity level for that resource changes. So I have access to this data until someone entered in a credit card number into the field that they shouldn't have, and now I can't see it, and it's now flagged as an item that needs to be addressed by our SOC team, for example.
I can see it's been super useful for a lot of data engineering work. but the risk of something like this in production will be kind of a nightmare. Some customer accidentally puts something that looks like a credit card number in a text field or something, or a phone number that looks like a social security number, and all of a sudden your app quits working because now it can't read the data from the data store anymore.
I would hope this is something you wouldn't necessarily use for machine accounts or service-to-service accounts. This, to me, is a person who's getting this type of access. Because this is where you care about the primitives and the context and those things. And this is a context that you are caring about based on the data sensitivity, and the context is important to an end user, not necessarily to the machine.
Mm-hmm. No, it's great.
Yeah, I like it quite a bit. I'm glad to see it. They are also giving you the ability to now prevent account takeovers with new certificate-based access. Stolen credentials are, of course, one of the most common attack vectors used by attackers to gain unauthorized access to user accounts and steal your information. Google is now providing certificate-based access in the IAM portfolio to help combat stolen credentials, cookie theft, and accidental credential loss. Certificate-based access uses mutual TLS to ensure that the user's credentials are bound to device certificate before authorizing access to the cloud resource. And CBA provides strong protection requiring the X509 certificate as a device identifier and verifies devices with user contacts for every access request to the cloud resource. Even if an attacker compromises the user's credentials, account access remain blocked as they don't have the corresponding certificate. I mean, that's a lot of words to just basically say we support X509 certificates, but again, appreciated.
Yeah, MFA with X509 certificates. Sounds great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, another factor of identification to protect your users and your systems.
It's a great level up, though, to protect, because you see all these articles online of like, oh, somebody got in and 12 things went wrong, or in someone's, you know, personal account, somebody's launched $30,000 worth of Bitcoin miners, you know, so a really good level up to see.
Yep. And then finally from Google, they're announcing expanded CIEM support to reduce multi-cloud risk in a security command center. Identities can be a major source of cloud risk when they are not properly managed. Compromised credentials are frequently used to gain unauthorized access to cloud environments, which often magnifies that risk since many users and service accounts are granted access to cloud services and assets beyond their required scope. This means that if just one credential is stolen or abused, companies may have a risk of data exfiltration and resource compromise. To make this easier, Google is integrating Cloud Infrastructure Entitlement Management, or CIEM, into Security Command Center, their multi-cloud security and risk tool, and are announcing the general availability of expanded CIEM support for additional clouds and identifiers, including AWS, EntreID, and Okta. And this is all about ensuring your entitlement is the right entitlement for you as the end user.
So does your SIEM data go into your SIEM?
I assume so. But yes, a terrible name. Seam to Seam. Yes. Also plugs into CNAP. There's actually a couple of companies that build this as its own service on the entitlements. I was just learning about this last week. So curious to see how Google continues to expand it. The first version is still a little limited, I think, in what it really provides you from an identity perspective. Mostly identification of risk. All right, moving on to Azure. So, of course, OpenAI has O1 reasoning. And so now OpenAI has, Azure OpenAI has O1 reasoning. And those are available to you in the Model Garden. And because Azure and OpenAI have that close, tight partnership, you can now use the O1 series to enable complex coding, math reasoning, brainstorming, and comparative analysis capabilities, setting a new benchmark for AI-powered solutions.
The Model Garden. That's just... It sounds so beautiful until you realize it's just a concrete building that uses millions of gallons of water a day. Yeah.
Yes, it does. Apparently, Azure is making their public IPs redundant by default. This means that unless you specifically select a single zone when deploying your Microsoft Azure standard public IPs, they will automatically be zone redundant without any extra steps on your part. Zone redundancy will be at no extra cost, and a zone redundant IP is created in three zones for a region and can survive any single zone failure, improving the resiliency of your application using the public IP. And I can just see the BGP nightmares now of something like this.
Well, no, think about it from so when I've started in Azure, I didn't realize that these weren't set up. And if you go try to attach a non-multi-zonal IP address to a multi-zonal service, it just yells at you. So to me, this is like one of those EIPs are all multi-zonal by default. You don't even think about what zone. Wait, are EIP? Now that I'm saying it out loud. EIPs are...
They are, yeah.
Yeah. So like you don't have to think about it. Mm-hmm. Where here you used to have to think about it. And then there was no migration path to say, hey, take this single zone IP address and move it to be multi-zone, even if you charge me more for it. There was nothing. So you like would have to completely change your IP address, which we all know customers never whitelist specific IP addresses. They never cause any problems.
Never.
You do that change.
Yeah. Never. They never have firewalls that don't support DNS for no. firewall rules. You know, never happens. But so my point on the BGP was their comment of zone redundant IP is created in three zones for a region. And I was just thinking, so then how do you know which one is active at any time? And if you're using, you know, basically if the networking between the sites is how you do the health check for that to then activate the public IP and that fails, then both public IPs now go active and the BGP basically goes, what the hell's happening? All these IPs are now active in both regions. Or zones in the region.
No, they just take down the whole region at once.
That's probably what happens. That's probably why Azure has so many outages. Like, that makes sense now. All right. Microsoft and Oracle are enhancing Oracle database at Azure, which this database edit at AWS, database at GCP is terrible naming. Terrible marketing. I don't know who came up with this. You guys should all be fired. Oracle database at Azure is getting those updates from the open world, and we'll talk more about open world a bit, but they're getting Fabric integration, so you can load all your Oracle data into Azure's very expensive Fabric overlay for doing your data analysis and data display with Power BI. Integration with Sentinel and compliance certificates to provide industry-leading security and compliance. Industry-leading, that's a stretch. And plans to expand to a total of 21 primary regions, each with at least two availability zones and support for Oracle's maximum availability architecture.
Out of all the companies who build Oracle database and resell it to cloud providers, Oracle is most definitely the industry leader.
Well, I agree, but they're not integrating with Oracle's industry leading Sentinel. They're integrating into Azure Sentinel. So yeah, okay, I get it. Microsoft Azure Container Team is giving you some gifts this week following the success of Advanced Networking Observability, which provided deep insights into network traffic of AKS clusters. They're now introducing fully qualified domain name filtering as a new security feature, and even showing you that new containerized things do require IP addresses, Matt, and don't support DNS. Until now.
Still baffles me.
Still baffles you. So Microsoft's going nuclear, guys.
They're, that's great.
I know. They've signed a deal to restart a power plant on Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania to power its rapidly expanding data center footprint for AI. The plan is for TMI Unit 1, which was shut down in 2019 for economic reasons, will be reopened and producing energy for Microsoft by 2028. For those of you who know Three Mile Island as the place where the the reactor partially melted down in 1979, that is a different reactor from TMI Unit 1. I believe that is TMI Unit 2. The reactor generated more than 800 megawatts of power when it was running in 2019, and Constellation Energy, the plant owner, is retrofitting the system to provide that power. And I somehow expect protests from people who are anti-nuclear at some point around this announcement. Guess what? All of that AI that you have and GPUs, they need power. And if you want to also hit your green energy carbon outputs, nuclear is a pretty good way to do it.
Yeah. I'm surprised.
More amazing that if they're going to grab 800 megawatts themselves.
Yeah, by themselves. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like just Microsoft's like, we need this much minimum. Like that's pretty much where they're at. And we're willing to pay for it no matter what.
And they're willing to wait for it till 2028. So they have expectations that not only is this plausible and something they can get the Nuclear Energy Commission to approve, but that they will still have AI dominating this much of their power consumption that they need 800 megawatts.
Either that or they're hoping that the Nuclear Commission says no, and that they can say, well, we tried to go green, and it makes them look good, too.
Mm-hmm. I think if they were smart, they'd build a data center right next to the nuclear power plant.
I was partially surprised they are not building a data center next to it. But we did talk about, was that Azure? There was somebody who's building data centers closer to some power generating facilities. Maybe that was Amazon. I don't remember. Or someone recently we talked about. Mm-hmm. But just too much. All right, Matt, this is your story. Azure is announcing the GA of Azure SQL Database Hyperscale Elastic Pools, which is a terrible Azure-esque name. They go say, while you may start with a standalone hyperscale database, chances are that as your fleet of databases grows, you want to optimize price and performance across a set of hyperscale databases. And these Elastic Pools offer the convenience of pooling the resources like CPU, memory, and I/O while ensuring strong security isolation between those databases. So buy in bulk, allocate where you want them to be, and you'll save some money, which I guess is what this is.
Yeah, I mean, it's no different than back in the day when you would take all your VMs on-prem and say, okay, cool, we had 100 gigabytes of memory. I'm going to allocate 200 gigabytes of memory to all your servers and hope that not all of them blow up at once because you know your workloads. So now you're able to do this with Hyperscale, which is equivalent to Aurora, but is actually with Microsoft SQL Engine. And it also gets rid of they've increased the storage price, but they've gotten rid of the SQL licensing. Yep. So it's now trying to be more comparable to just like Aurora, MySQL, or just MySQL in general. Mm-hmm. At that tier, which, so it's interesting to see Microsoft kind of backing down from the license game and everything else to get with their cloud native SQL database.
Yeah. Yeah. The other example here, they're showing like you have eight databases with four vCores each. That would basically cost you $4,267 a month. And you're typically not using 100% of your CPU, because if you did it on a SQL server, you'll have a bad time. And so basically by combining those eight database servers into an elastic pool with 10 vCores, you're only spending $16.99 a month, and you're able to dynamically allocate those resources between the eight databases. So it's virtualization in the cloud for SQL, basically.
And yeah, they've had it for normal SQL server, like their managed SQL, for a while. It just took them a pretty long time to add it to Hyperscale, which has been GA'd for a while.
On the back end, it kind of sounds like placement groups and not dedicated hardware for VMs, right? It sounds like you've got dedicated hypervisors running the database services virtually, but now there's not, and now you have they're sharing cores. They must be sharing cores. So this is pretty much what people were doing on VMware 20 years ago.
Yeah. But in the cloud.
But that's one of the negative parts of the cloud, is that you can't over-provision, and that's where containers, Kubernetes, you can then over-provision. And now, so here's a way to actually over-provision with the SQL. Yeah. But with Hyperscale, you're also killing the Microsoft licensing. So for just moving from business critical, you know, which is, so if your standard SQL is $1, business critical is $4, you know, plus, now you're probably at about $3 or so, you know, with the same compute that you were spending $4 for, mm-hmm. by killing off the licensing. So if you can move horizontally, and it gets rid of all the storage limitations. Same with the RDS, used to have that like 4 terabyte limit. This is like 100 terabytes. You just can't tell. I deal with this a little bit in my day job. So I've read a little bit and know a little bit about this, which is why I was excited for it, because I've been waiting for like 6 months for them to GA this.
Yeah, I'm. It sounds good. It sounds valuable.
To get cost,
I can't help but feel like they're solving a problem that they created themselves, though. In this,
100%.
Well, SQL's 45 years.
That's a nice way to put it.
Yeah, SQL's 25 years old.
They screwed it. They screwed you as a customer. Now they're screwing you as a customer less. That's what's happening.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, the big one's getting rid of the licensing, and them trying to compete with the standard open source SQL platforms now.
Mm-hmm. Well, screwing your customers is an excellent segue to talk about Oracle Open World. So there was a lot at Open World. I've already filtered this down quite a bit before I even put it in the show notes, and then the guy still said it's a lot. So I'm trying to save their sanity a little bit. We won't go into deep into all of these, but I'll try to combine a bunch of things together here and kind of give you the Cliff Notes version. And if you really care about Oracle that much, you can check it out in the show notes. But Oracle Kubernetes Engine, or OKE, OKE has a bunch of features, including that it is the new best platform to run AI workloads. It means you can connect your Kubernetes Engine to GPU-based VMs. Cool. They're giving you new container security with a limited beta release of a container governance model through Oracle's CloudGuard Container Security. They'll tell you if your containers are unsecure, running things they shouldn't be, or whatever. They're giving you enhanced monitoring for OKE with logging analytics. Basically, they now send your Kubernetes logs to the OCI logging service, where you pay for every log it generates. Enjoy paying that bill. They now support OpenID Connect in Oracle Kubernetes Engine, which is always appreciated. And they're making it simpler to add OCI Kubernetes Engine add-ons, including things like the Kubernetes Cluster Autoscaler, the Istio Service Mesh, the OCI Native Ingress Controller, and the Kubernetes Metric Server. That is all the Oki features announced at Open World. Quite a few.
Okie dokie.
That's cool. Actually, the virtualization of GPUs is really valuable. I don't think anyone else is doing it as well as Oracle are. I know NVIDIA only just released the open source version of the GPU virtualization software just in the last week or so. So that's actually really impressive from Oracle.
Well, mark that out somewhere that Jonathan was impressed with Oracle.
Yeah, I was like, I don't think those two words have ever been said in the same sentence in a positive manner.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to other things. If you need a message bus that isn't Oracle's proprietary one, they are now supporting Kafka as a managed service. And if you like to keep your enemies closer than your friends, OCI database with Postgres is now available to you with several new features, including version 13, 14, and 15 support, as well as extension support for Postgres. You can also get asset and resource management for your OCI environment with their new centralized inventory and advanced troubleshooting, and glean insights from the OCI resource dashboard, which is just a pretty dashboard for someone in security to know what your resources are. They are now supporting GPUs on the Oracle Machine Learning Notebooks. These are Jupyter Notebooks, so now you can get access to a GPU directly from that. For those of you trying to code NetSuite SuiteScript customizations, which I don't know if that's anybody on the podcast, it's definitely not me, and I will never do that. You'll be pleased to know that Oracle Code Assist now will help you write not only JavaScript, but also will help you write NetSuite SuiteScript support in addition to Python, JavaScript, SuiteScript, Rust, Ruby, Go, PLSQL, C Sharp, and C, all available to you directly in the plugin for your IDE of choice.
Did not know NetSuite was an Oracle product.
It was bought many years ago at this point. And it has been, no one has risen from the ashes to create the next big ERP SaaS. I guess Workday's trying, but there's really not anybody that is sort of similar to NetSuite. For your OCI object storage, you can now use private endpoints with private IP addresses, because that's going to be fun to manage. I'd like to pass on that, but if you need that support and security for your highly compliant workloads like HIPAA, you do need this ability to make sure that none of your traffic crosses to the public internet to get to your object storage.
Isn't this like an S3 endpoint?
It is. Yep.
Yeah.
Got it. Just making sure I wasn't missing something.
And a terribly named service called OCI Fleet Application Manager is now generally available. And you think this has to do with managing your applications, and you'd be wrong. Has to do with centralized management and patch operations across your entire cloud stack that is made up into an application. So it allows you to patch and manage your stacks for your application fleet, not manage your application. So I see what you did there, Oracle, and I don't like it. They also give you high performance multi-point attached storage for all of your training operations for OCI storage. So if you're trying to do big, large ML training, they now give you up to 40 gigabits per second of throughput to that. They have several other improvements coming for like an HDFS connector for Hadoop, because people are still using that apparently, as well as they'll be scaling their storage 10x. They'll be giving you file storage with Lustre, file storage you just quoted, object storage support for multiple checksums, file storage with a 30-minute RPO, and block volume support for customer managed keys for cross-region replication, all coming soon.
30-minute RPO doesn't feel that good.
I thought it was not great either, but they did say that's the initial launch. They're going to try to speed up from there.
Okay. Because I know many companies that have like an RPO of like 15 minutes.
I mean, if the use case is AI training data shared amongst massive training clusters, then it's 30 minutes is perfectly fine.
Yeah. Oracle's building out standardized OCI landing zones and OCI with zero trust landing zones. So this gives you the ability to rapidly onboard your Oracle Cloud journey with standard basic things like IAM, KMS, CloudGuard, vulnerability scanning, bastions, logging, and events, notifications, and security zones all configured for you as part of that, as well as enabling ZTNA for your application and workloads. This also includes OCI access governance, OCI Zero Trust packet routing, and networking enhancements with next-gen firewalls like Fortinet's FortiGate and observability enhancements, as well as a very handy reference architecture for learning how to do all your things. This is all based on the CISA and UK government's National Cyber Secure Center guidelines for secure cloud computing, so you can get a much faster start to your OCI journey.
Cool. Everyone should be doing this.
Yes, agreed. We talked about AWS, but Oracle has expanded all of their multi-cloud partnerships, including AWS, Google Cloud, and Microsoft Azure. We talked about AWS, but Oracle Database at Azure is now in 6 Azure data centers, with that increasing to 15 very soon. And Google is now GA in 4 Google Cloud regions, with expansion to additional regions in progress. So if you need to get your Oracle database in your cloud of choice, it's now available to you. Oracle is announcing the first Zettascale cloud computing cluster accelerated by NVIDIA Blackwell platform. OCI is now taking orders for the largest AI supercomputer in the cloud, available with up to 131,072 NVIDIA Blackwell GPUs. And I just had to ask, was this built for Elon first?
Sounds like an XAI thing to me.
Yep.
I just want to know what did it cost per second.
I don't know. They didn't release pricing. But the 131,072 NVIDIA Blackwell GPUs deliver 2.4 zettaflops of peak performance. The maximum scale of an OCI supercluster offers more than 3 times as many GPUs as the Frontier supercomputer and more than 6 times that of other hyperscalers. They support both the H100 and the H100 Tensor Core GPU from the NVIDIA Blackwell GPU family. There's a quote here from Mahesh Thiagarajan, Executive Vice President of Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. We have one of the broadest AI infrastructure offerings and are supporting customers that are running some of the most demanding AI workloads in the cloud. With Oracle's distributed cloud, customers have the flexibility to deploy cloud and AI services wherever they choose while preserving the highest levels of data and AI sovereignty. That's a big server.
Yeah. When they say taking orders, I assume it's that they're building this one of these things and you can rent time on it.
What I would take too. So okay, like they originally were building this for Elon, then Elon got mad and he said, I'm going to go build my own thing. And they was like, well, we're already building it. We already have the GPUs coming. Let's figure out who else wants this. That's what this feels like to me.
Wow, it's insane. I saw a graph the other day. It was actually a YouTube video I was watching, which was talking about the kind of like the limits of training and how there seems to be this limit of how much compute you have to put into reducing the errors in these large language models. And the way they measure how much compute is required for training is petaflop hours or petaflop days.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just...
Zettaflop is, 1,000 petaflops?
Another 1,000 on top of that.
Oof, that's a lot.
I think it was like 150 days or 100... Don't quote me on it. I'm going to say something between like 150 or 180 days worth of compute time to train GPT-4. Something like this, obviously there's other constraints than just floating point operations, like this memory access, everything else to go into it, but something like this, we could be looking at training a GPT like system in weeks instead of months or years.
Yeah, if you're fully utilizing it.
Yeah, I imagine this governments will be interested in this, renting this as well.
Yes, maybe 3-letter government agencies as
well. I would think so, yeah. Or a Palantir may want to rent some time on it too.
All right, and our last Oracle Open World announcement. I got you through it pretty quickly, guys.
Thank you.
We appreciate that.
You're welcome. Oracle announced Generative Development, or GenDev, for Enterprises, a groundbreaking AI-centric application development infrastructure which provides innovative development technologies that enables developers to rapidly generate sophisticated applications and make it easy for applications to use AI-powered natural language inference interfaces and human-centric data. GenDev combines technologies in Oracle Database 23 AI, including JSON relational duality views, AI vector search, and Apex to facilitate development using Gen AI. Some of the features of this include Oracle Autonomous Database Select AI with RAG and other enhancements, which is basically around broad support for LLMs and leveraging things like Gemini, Anthropic, Claude, and Hugging Face LLMs. Autonomous Database NVIDIA GPU support, allowing you to access NVIDIA GPUs to accelerate performance of certain AI data operations. Data Studio enhancements, Graph Studio enhancements, Autonomous Database for Developers, Autonomous Database for Developers Container Images, and Autonomous Database Select AI Synthetic Data Creation, which is all a bunch of gobbledygook to me. So I'm hoping that Juan Loaiza, Executive Vice President of Mission Critical Database Technology at Oracle's, quote, will help us determine what this is. Just as paved roads had to be built for us to get the full benefit of cars, we have to change the application development infrastructure to get the full benefit of AI app generation. GenDev enables developers to harness AI to swiftly generate modular, evolvable enterprise applications that are understandable and safe, and users can interact with data and applications using natural language and find data based on its semantic content. Oracle Database 23 AI provides the AI-centric infrastructure needed to dramatically accelerate generative development for enterprise apps. Well, he didn't help. I think I can summarize this down to, this is a lot of good marketing for nothing.
I don't know. I don't know about nothing. I mean, there's using GPTs and Claudes and things to write code prompt by prompt. And then there's building a system which is whose purpose is to enable developers to build an application. So I can see how there's value in things like, you know, document stores, reference information, technical decisions, like a way of organizing the structure of projects so that a developer can better use a tool to reach the end goal. So I actually think this is probably a really good product aimed at helping kind of organize and like shepherd the whole process through, because, I mean, sure, you can sit down in front of ChatGPT and ask you to write some code, but with a limited context window, you have to kind of keep copying stuff out or restarting the chat. You have to keep referring back to original design documents, which is kind of cumbersome. And so solving the usability of these systems to actually deliver applications is great. And I wish them well with it. I'd really like to play with it.
Yeah. I mean, it might be not all marketing, but it definitely feels like, how do we give you Oracle Database 23 AI and then give you something that makes you more locked into an Oracle database than ever before with your new application development? That's why I felt it was a little marketing.
That's fair. I mean, I'd take it without the Oracle database kind of requirement. I assume it's not a requirement. I'm sure like you could use it to write any code you like, but
yeah. Well, that's it for a massive show once again this week, guys. Any last minute thoughts here before we head out about Oracle Open World? I'm glad I didn't attend. I would have been very bored.
Are you doing reInvent this year or no?
I am not going to do reInvent this year. If you saw my travel schedule between now and the end of November, you wouldn't go to reInvent either.
I wasn't interested in going this year, even if it was an option. So
I actually really enjoyed Google Next the last 2 years. It's been nice to see a different perspective. We should talk about if we're going to do a live stream during reInvent keynotes again, I think this year, because I think that was fun. And number one, and number two, I don't have to be there for that. I can be at my house.
Yep.
And live streaming it is fun. So yeah, I think that's definitely probably a possibility for us. We'll have the new CEO this year on main stage, I assume. I assume Werner hasn't quit yet from going back to the office 5 days a week. So I assume he'll be there by then, and you know, it'll be good.
Mm. Yeah, I'm just concerned that it's going to be AI everything.
I'm sort of worried, but I do feel like there is sort of some noise of, you know, I'll take it back. Let's go back to Oracle Open World real quick. I was sort of pleased that it wasn't all AI. Mm-hmm. Like there was hardware things in there. The Zettascale thing, I guess it's train AI models, but still it's hardware. You know, some of the things they did around security for Kubernetes engine and the Kubernetes enhancements. Yes. Some of that are support OpenAI, but there was more than just AI. And so, you know, from that perspective, Oracle Open World had the least AI, you know, focused keynotes I've seen yet. And I kind of appreciated that. So maybe AWS and Google and Microsoft will take a hint that, you know, the AI stuff is cool and you can be doing cool hardware things that we can use for other use cases than just AI.
Yep.
Or is it that they're so far behind that they're still catching up on the basics?
I mean, that's a possibility too, but that's the one that means that we're going to get nothing but AI at reInvent. So I'm rejecting that idea.
I would also like to reject that idea, but you know, I think we have Microsoft's Ignite coming up first, so that might be a good insight to what AWS is going to be too.
Yeah. When is Insights?
November, like
Ignite, right?
The 18th, I think, or so.
Yeah, November 19th through the 21st. So it's basically, well, it's in Chicago.
The week before.
It sold out. Yeah.
It actually sold out pretty quickly.
AI is a big topic. So, you know. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see, you know, kind of, but it won't be enough to change the direction of reInvent. It's only 2 weeks before reInvent, basically. And one of those weeks in between is Thanksgiving. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I feel like they all kind of march in the same direction.
Yep. All right, guys. Well, we will see you next week here at the Cloud Pod.
Yep. See you later.
Yeah.
And that is the Week in Cloud. Check out our website, the home of the Cloud Pod, where you can join our newsletter, Slack team, send feedback, or ask questions at thecloudpod.net, or tweet us with the hashtag #PoundTheCloudPod.